listening to Why So Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Emily McCord, filling in for Jerry Kenny. Today, WYSO's Juliet Frumholt speaks to Kyle Melton and Don Thrasher. They're with the local band The Smug Brothers, and they're releasing a new album on Tuesday. Then we bring you a story out of Yellow Springs. It's a holiday tradition that's been happening every year since 1894. But first, we bring you Soshi Talks. The Soshi Talks are a collaboration with the Southwest Ohio Council for Higher Education. And in this monthly series, we hear from faculty and staff from area colleges and universities on a wide variety of subjects. Today, we are going to hear from Riyad Ajami. He's with the Center for Global Business at Wright State University, and he's speaking on the challenges of market and U.S. oil consumers.
If one goes back, every U.S. president since the days of Richard Nixon did speak about our dependence on foreign oil, and each president have promised that eventually we will not be dependent on foreign oil. So what we are going to be doing today is taking a look at these policy options that were advanced recently by President Obama, and as far back as President Nixon. Can we be totally independent in our way of life and not use foreign oil? To set things in perspective, we are an energy-intensive economy in the United States. For each unit of our economic output, we use a great deal of oil. We can turn around and not use any imported foreign oil, but our economic options will be constrained, our economic fortunes will be even much worse. And what I'm going to speak about, that we still will need oil, either we produce it ourselves or we get it from somebody else. To put things in perspective, if you take a look at oil consumption in the United States, we consume roughly about 19 million barrels of oil a day. We'll produce roughly no more than 7 million barrels of oil a day. So when you put these numbers in perspective, you begin to understand, to meet our needs for energy and oil, we need to import somebody else's oil. Now, if we take a look at where do we get our oil, in the United States, of course, I indicated to you that we use some oil onshore, offshore. And beyond that, of course, we get our oil from Canada, from Mexico, from Saudi Arabia, from Venezuela. So when you put these numbers in perspective, you understand that we are dependent on foreign oil suppliers, some coming from OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Some are coming from friendly and neighborly countries such as Canada and Mexico. But make no mistake about it, when the price of oil goes up, whether it is OPEC oil or our own oil, or whether it is Canadian or Mexican oil, there is a global market for oil that is uniform. So foreigners are not going to give us cheap oil. Our oil producers are not going to give us cheap oil. So if you take a look at the average price today for a barrel of oil, as of today, it's about $110 for a barrel of oil. That $110, of course, has built into it about $30 of a risk premium. What is a risk premium? It's what market deems that it's going to be risky or costly to get the next barrel of oil. The risk premium is roughly about $30. If you deduct that out of $110, then you begin to understand that oil today should be priced at roughly $80 for a barrel of oil. Now, why is the price so high? If you take a look at the players in the oil market and the sources of oil and the consumption of oil, you begin to see some indication of why do we have a high price for every barrel of oil. Now, the oil consumers, be it the Chinese or be it now the Indians, who are competing with us, China today is the second largest consumer of oil after us. They have an emerging, burgeoning economy that needs oil. So as a result of that, of course, they are going to be competing with us for the same barrel of oil that we are in need of. So we need to think about how can we secure our share of this global market of oil and hopefully manage to have access to oil. And that's what I intend to explain at a more detail what I'm talking about. If you take a look at the average production cost for a barrel of oil, in the Middle East, it's $5. In the United States, it's anywhere from 15 and up. If you think of the oil shale coming from Canada, it needs to be roughly at least $30 or $40. So when you begin to take a look at the numbers, you see that oil prices allow us to have a group of players, which are the oil producers of the Middle East, have a comparative advantage over the rest of us. Now, of course, in the Middle East, there is always one certainty, and that certainty is political instability. And there have always been a premium on the future barrel of oil coming out of the Middle East. The Middle Eastern oil producers, as well as the Caspian Sea producers and Kazakhstan, among others, are sitting on two-thirds of known petroleum reserves of this planet. We only have 4% of known petroleum reserves, but we consume almost one quarter of daily consumption on this planet. Roughly today, we are producing 88 million barrels of oil a day. All of us are consuming the same that we are producing. So if supply and demand are in balance, then you ask, why should the oil price go higher? The oil price goes higher every day because there is an anticipation that tomorrow's barrel of oil is going to cost a little more. We don't know what the other issues that surround political instability in the region. We also are going to have to understand that China and India, as new arrivals to the global economy, are in need of far more oil. So these are the overall determinant of why do we have an increase in the price of a barrel of oil. And the next question we need to ask ourselves, what can we do about that? Naturally, if you take a look at the players in the oil market, you have the familiar names of Exxon, Shell, Chevron, BP. And these companies produce and sell a lot of oil, and they make a lot of money at it. 2 days ago, Exxon published their numbers. Quarterly profits were roughly about $11 billion. Over a year, this year, Exxon will be making roughly $40 billion. In addition to Exxon, everybody else will be making far more money simply because of the factors that we spoke about. The political uncertainty and the speculators have added $30 to the price of each barrel of oil. And these companies have already bought their oil, but nevertheless, they are pricing it as if the new barrel of oil is going to continue to stay at the same level that it is today. So with these in mind, what can we do in order for us to begin to understand that this global oil market, oil is strategic, it's important for all of us. When its price goes higher, naturally it's going to impact not our transportation needs, but also our other things that goes into petrochemicals. From CDs to other products, they have lots of petrochemicals. And when the price of a barrel of oil goes higher, it translates itself throughout the market. Your food will cost you a little more simply because the trucker who's bringing your food is going to have to pay more for their oil. And as a result of that, of course, we begin to see this ripple effect throughout the market. So given that, what is it that we can do as a society that is dependent on oil, domestic and foreign, to bring about some of these changes? For one, we can ask and look into the mode of strategic linkages between the oil producers and the companies that sell you gasoline, the retail outlet. The largest oil producer on this planet is Saudi Arabia. One company, Aramco by itself, produces 8, 9, 10 million barrels of oil a day within this global market, approaching, of course, 88 million barrels. These guys naturally are producing at an average price of $5. They need to sell their oil to their retailers. The retail buyers are here in the United States. It's you and I who need this specific oil. So can we create a framework whereby the largest oil producers from the oil producing states, from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and other countries, whose average production cost is very low, to engage and link with our retail outlets in the American market? At your next street corner, hopefully, you may be able to see a sign that says Exxon, maybe Exxon Aramco. And for that situation whereby you have oil producers producing oil at $5 for a barrel, wanting to get closer to their customers, you and I, the largest consumers of oil on this planet. So you create what is known as market-to-market transactions, where companies coming from state-owned sources in the Middle East and North Africa, linking with privately traded oil companies here, whether they are Shell and a few other companies. So these market-to-market would probably give us some possibilities of having access to an oil that is priced at a lower price than what we see today. Another reason we can think about some possibilities that maybe tomorrow could be a better place for access to oil markets is to take a look at the Middle East and North Africa. If you take a look at the production of oil from the Middle East and North Africa, it needs to go through strategic waterways, the Gulf, as well as the Suez Canal. And, of course, if you take a look today in the Middle East and across from the Suez Canal and the Gulf oil producers, you will see U.S. military ships with individuals sitting around watching the flow of oil from that specific region. The oil that is produced in the Middle East and North Africa arrives to world markets courtesy of the protection of the U.S. Navy. So could we, as a country, needing to have access to this strategic commodity, ask the oil producers, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, and some of them who are our friends and dependent on us strategically, to pay into a fund for the protection of the oil that leaves their shores. And that fund will be ultimately used to look into alternative energy and other ways through which oil prices may not be as high as they are today. So that is another solution. So in addition to the solution that we are looking at market to market, we are also looking at state to state, government to government. The current administration can ask the oil producers, the ones who we helped in Kuwait when Saddam Hussein invaded that specific country and we had to go defend them, and the Saudis who are dependent on us. And today, our ships are standing across in the Mediterranean, across from Libya. We can ask for these arrangements, which would allow us to have access to a strategic commodity such as oil. That would be the other solutions. So if you want to take a look at mitigating the impact of high oil prices, we are looking into market-to-market, strategic alliances between oil companies coming from the Middle East as well as our companies here. We can begin to look at strategic linkages and the provision, of course, of protection for these exports of oil coming out on ships from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere. If we put all these together, we begin to create a situation where the structure for a pricing for a fair oil may be desirable and may help us. Next time when we drive into gasoline station, our shocks are likely to be much less than they would be. Finally, I'd like to speak about a number of other situations that would allow us to become consumers with behavioral tendencies that would allow us naturally to control in a small way the increase in the price of oil. We can become energy efficient. We can begin to look onto alternative modes of transportation which would lower the price of oil. We can begin, of course, to understand that all the fixes that we have out there are no more than fixes. Next time you hear your officials in the United States government speaking about not being dependent on foreign oil, you should know it is not correct. We will always be dependent, at least in the short term and long term, on foreign oil, coming from countries that we don't subscribe to their notions of governments, but nevertheless, they produce oil, they need to sell it, and we need to buy it. So if we begin to be careful about reducing our consumption of oil, particularly in the transportation sector, we begin to move in the right direction. There have been also a lot of discussions today about other sources. Of course, biofuels are going to be the fix that would allow us to walk away from high oil prices. The numbers are not there yet. So biofuels will be higher. And finally, of course, if you take a look at all these options, you need to be focusing on looking at the role of government, market to market, and the role of consumers. If we do that together, we are likely to see at least oil prices increasing at a much smaller rate than we have seen for the last 2-3 decades. Ohio is the 7th largest exporting state in the Union. We export a lot of things. We are also dependent on oil as well as other imports into the United States as well as exports. With that in mind, thank you and have a good day. Bye-bye.
This Tuesday marks the release of a new EP by local band The Smug Brothers. It's called Treasure Virgins and is being released on cassette by Gas Daddy Go. It's a local record label making a comeback with this release. Kaleidoscope host Juliet Frumholt spoke with Kyle Melton and Don Thrasher, two members of The Smug Brothers, who are also at the helm of Gas Daddy Go. She began by asking them about the decision to release the albums on cassette tape.
Well, you know, there are a few people around, you know, putting out cassette releases. I mean, it's not something that's ever gone away completely. I mean, there are a few people that have kind of stuck to that format. And I don't know, Kyle and I just kind of, I guess, had gotten copies of some local cassettes that, like, Hirokin recently put out a cassette, and the Footbinder guys, and, you know, Factotum has been putting out cassettes for a while. And we kind of were looking at the model that they do, where they give you, sell the cassette, but you get the digital download with it too. So you get the analog and digital together. So you can still put it in your iPod or your whatever pod you have and play it. So it's, you know, old school, new school, a little bit combined. So we're going to give it a try and see what happens. So we're kind of reviving my old label, Gas Daddy Go, which I did in the 80s and 90s, and a little bit, you know, off and on. It was never a real serious thing, but we put out quite a few things. We did cassettes back in the day and also did CDs and a little bit of vinyl, 7 inches and things. So we're hoping to, you know, I don't know if we'll be doing any CDs, but, you know, we're hoping to get into vinyl here sometime and things like that. But in the new year, we'll have releases from quite a few local bands, Motel Beds, and who else? King Elk, O'Condor,
Astrofang,
Me and Mountain. So we got a lot of people interested in kind of in the queue, as it were, to kind of have a big 2012, we hope, with the new Revive label and all that stuff. And hopefully we'll have a full length in 2012 as well. So
when you release that full length, is the idea going to be to
offer it on exclusively analog format with a download code, or for a full length, would you consider doing like a CD and an analog?
Well, we haven't really got that far yet, but most likely if we issue a full length, it'll be probably either the cassette, stick with the cassette, or we'd obviously like to do vinyl, so, and then with the digital download code. So we'll probably put it out that way.
Yeah, probably plan. Not too many CDs. I mean, it seems like it's kind of going the way of the dinosaur almost. So we'll see. I mean, we're not going to say no to anything, because sometimes that might be the most economical way to go. So we just have to take it on a case-by-case basis, and we're definitely not going to say no. But right now, I mean, we're looking at the cassettes and really looking, hopefully, to do vinyl. So it's definitely a goal.
As far as the cassettes go, I know that VHS cassettes have become sort of this niche collector's market. Do you find that audio cassettes are the same way, and does that allow you to reach maybe a different type of music fan?
I guess we'll find out about that. It's kind of an experiment from us. But, I mean, there is that kind of analog group of people that definitely collect cassettes. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal just like a month or so ago about that exact thing, people collecting tape players and going and buying old blank cassettes or old factory cassettes, you know, and just collecting all that stuff. So we'll see if we can tap into that a little bit. I mean, certainly. But, I mean, the main thing is we're just about the music and trying to write good songs that people want to listen to. So whatever it takes, if we have to sell them on flash drive, I guess we could think about doing that as well. I mean, I guess I'm not against that. You could put all kind of stuff on a flash drive, so.
Tell me about the decision to revive the label. Was it just something that, as you were getting ready to release the Smug Brothers album, came up? Or was it something that y'all had been thinking about for a while?
As far as I know, we weren't really thinking about it. We hadn't talked about it at all. And it just kind of came down to, well, how are we going to put this Treasure Virgins thing out? And again, seeing how like bands like Hirokin and Footbinder are putting out cassette, it seemed like, well, that seems like a lot more fun than putting out another CD. And I put the idea to Don, like, hey, wouldn't it be more fun to put out a cassette? And, you know, and he's like, well, yeah, sure. I was thinking about reviving Gas Daddy Go anyway. I guess he'd been thinking about that on his own. And so we just kind of went with that. And
there is a lot of great music in town. And I've always, even when I wasn't running the label, I've always, you know, I look at stuff and go, well, I would love to put out something from those guys. I wish more people would hear this. I wish I could help them do that, you know. And I guess that's kind of what we're trying to do here. You know, the people we like, because there's so much good music, you know. I mean, and it a lot of times only falls, you know, in a select group of people that hear it. And we'd like to try to do our part to kind of let everybody work together and try to grow this thing so people really know what the heck's going on around here.
Are you going to focus exclusively on local releases, or do you envision maybe expanding into, you know, say, regional artists, or even, you know, connections you have with artists around the country?
Well, I mean, we're going to start with local just because it's there, and we definitely want to give a voice to that. But, I mean, we've kicked around the idea of some national, regional stuff. I mean, because we do know a lot of people around that I think would maybe enjoy working with us. So, again, we'll see where it goes. I don't know.
Right. We don't want to bite off too much, you know, too soon, because we have a lot of people already asking us to, you know, to do stuff, and we just take it on a case-by-case basis. But we definitely would love to be able to branch out and work with some other people, I think.
Where can people go both to get more information about future releases from the label and to get the Smug Brothers album?
You can find all that on Bandcamp. For the Smug Brothers specifically, just go to smugbrothers.bandcamp.com, and Gas Daddy Go, just go to gasdaddygo.bandcamp.com.
Kyle, Don, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks,
Juliet. Thank you.
Thank you.
Spirit. My name is Kelly Fox, and I am the Superintendent of Electric and Water Distribution in the Public Works Department for the Village of Yellow Springs. I've lived in Yellow Springs all my life.
Kelly Fox also has been participating in a longtime Yellow Springs tradition. Every year around this time, he and others that work for the village go around delivering 10-pound sacks of flour and sugar to widows in Yellow Springs. The story goes back to 1894, when a philanthropist named Wheeling Gaunt died, leaving a legacy that lives to this day.
He was born in Carrollton County, Kentucky in 1812, and he worked as a slave for 32 years. He was manumitted in 1845, which means that his slave owner basically allowed him to purchase himself from slavery. He purchased himself for $900 and later moved north and thankfully ended up in Yellow Springs. He became quite wealthy in town, and he used it peddling. He made his money peddling apples and blackening boots. And when he passed away, or before he passed away, he had a will donating 10 acres of land, now known as Gaunt Park, where the swimming pool is and the baseball diamonds and soccer fields. He actually left this in his will, the land to Yellow Springs in his will, with the stipulation that Yellow Springs provide the flour for at that time, worthy widows of Yellow Springs. At the time it was willed, it was flour only, and then has since become flour and sugar.
And so the tradition continues. The village keeps a list of widows. It's about 100 each year. They purchase the flour and sugar from the local grocery market in town. And every December, for about a week, they set out to make their deliveries.
We knock on the door and let the widows know that we have their flour and sugar. And most of them know what it's about, and they know the story. But some don't, so we explain to them why we're here and what the whole story is about. And the reaction varies. Times, depending on how new the widow is. Some of the newer ones obviously would be more emotional with the delivery, just, you know, as far as remembering their love lost. It's kind of a double-edged thing sometimes. It's because you're bringing back the memories of someone that's lost. And Christmas time is already, the holidays are already a time of thinking and remembering. So we're just kind of going along with that tradition, I guess. And then a lot of them are just happy to see us come when we pull in the driveway. Some it's a conversation, you know, can sit and chat for a while, you know. So we don't rush through the deliveries. We'll sit and talk with them for a while if they want to. Definitely at the time, that was 1894, so it's been 117 years ago, when people didn't quite have as much as they do now. So flour definitely helped them out. Initially, that's what the gesture was, but since then, it's grown into so much more than that. It shows the mindset of the folks of Yellow Springs. I think he was before his time. Here, I think he realized what Yellow Springs was, and that's one of the reasons he stayed here.
That's it for this week's Why So Weekend. I'm Emily McCord, filling in for Jerry Kenny. If you missed any part of today's program, you can catch it online at wyso.org. Before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham to give us a sneak peek at the Sunday Documentary Hour.
Tune in tonight at 6 p.m. for a rebroadcast of WYSO's Community Voices Special, an hour of radio stories by, for, and about the Miami Valley from WYSO's first Community Voices training program. You'll meet the leader of the Oakwood Accordion Band, travel to Tucumcari, New Mexico, consider tourism in Yellow Springs, and explore the legacy of Paul Lawrence Dunbar. Don't miss stories from YSO's Community Voices producers tonight at 6 p.m. You can get all the details on future trainings by signing up for the Community Voices mailing list at wyso.org. And tonight at 11 p.m., we'll bring you a brand new episode of the Moth Radio Hour. In this week's show, a young woman born to a white mother and black father is asked to keep her two different worlds separate. A reckless partier gets shipwrecked and has to sober up enough to save the day, and an author contends with her unsupportive mother on her deathbed. That's tonight at 11 p.m. on the Moth Radio Hour.
This is 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, broadcasting in HD and online at WYSO.org. WYSO is a service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. It's 11 o'clock.